speaker is Steven Sun, talking about isotope effect beyond the electromagnetic force.
Anyway, I think the organizing commission and Melvin Miles, especially for the opportunity to come here. I haven't seen him since I got here a few days ago. I gave a talk at Illinois State University where I work, and they just are now celebrating the separation of the chemistry and physics departments. So, I thought that was kind of analogous. And also, I guess this talk is coming close to the sixth anniversary of the Higgs, which involves symmetry breaking, and I do want to mention a little bit about symmetry breaking. John is one of my former graduate students. He's right back there, and we started a little business up, and we make batteries. It has nothing to do with cold fusion. We got interested in cold fusion. It real recently, actually, when we saw a 60 Minutes version of what Dr. McCoubrey's been doing. And the interest, this comes from the absurdity of what the scientific community has done to super respected scientists, award winners, and it seems to be a bit of an atrocity. But I want to start talking about something that we were doing before D-Day. And this is 1986, about 3 years before, and one of my grad students at that time, Matt Espy, notice that if you had, in this particular case, carbon that is perdeuterated and percopiated carbon and a benzene moiety, and you add an efficient number of electrons, that the isotopically right molecule has preference for the electron. The electron desires the light. That's an EPR spectrum. We do a lot of that, but there's no interest in that maybe here. But it's a way of looking at these as deuterons or protons. And one thing I wanted to point out, if you can look at that, you can see if you're into EPR, that the deuterium is indeed a triplet. It's got a smaller general magnetic ratio than does a proton. The other little problem that comes up is why is the deuterium joined? Because it shouldn't be, really. It's a spin triplet. So it's the old Hund's rule thing. If they come together, they're going to fall apart, the neutron proton. But we get around that with isospin. And actually, Heisenberg made that up. Now it's part of the electron count rule to figure out isospin. It's a real entity, it has nothing to do with spin. But the neutron is a minus one-half isospin. The proton is a plus one-half. So it's a triplet spin, singlet isospin. You don't have the degeneracy pressure. It can obey Fermi Dirac statistics. But the important point is that the electron destabilizes loosened bonds and raises energy. And it does so more so for the deuterated than the proteated. Years later, with a couple of grad students, we teamed up with Westport at University of Wisconsin. And we were able to understand this quantitatively, perfectly, just, you know, from the harmonic oscillator, density functional theory, published that in Jackson way back, 20 years ago, I guess. And it's really just a matter of the partition functions of the heavy anion radical over the light and the reverse for the light system. So it's easy to understand But what's kind of important here, that we did this with carbon systems a lot, what we were starting to do with metal systems. But I put an X there, indicating that it doesn't have to be carbon. We've done these with a series of carbon-type molecules. But as I said, the point is that you add an electron to a XHXHXH moiety, and energy goes up. It goes up dramatically, bonds loosen dramatically. And I'll show you how dramatically. And I realized, of course, that, you know, that palladium-deuteron system is not quite that simple. It's not linear. I think the carbon analogy is still good. But we do some molecular modeling. I just started to build the cage there. I didn't build the whole thing for palladium-deuteron. So we can do some molecular modeling with it and be truly analogous to the carbon system I showed you before. I put the time-dependent shortage equation there this time just to remind us that, you know, this is a much more complicated system, and we have perturbations upon perturbations, nonlinear equations, extreme time dependence on the initial and the final state. But the point is here that if you have this cage system, and we know this is three-dimensional, but if you warm it up, what it's going to do is start spinning out deuterions. If you have protons present there, that yellow one is one in a period. You have protons present, it'll spit those out too, but the bonds to the deuterium are loosened preferentially. So the deuteriums come off preferentially, thermodynamically, to the protons. And we've done a lot of this stuff for you with this slide, but just to show you how dramatic this effect can be, that naphthalene, we just have naphthalene, you can heat that to 1,000 degrees, your product is hot naphthalene. Put an electron in it, you can pass it through electronically, or just drop it in chemically, the naphthalene will now, you just warm it, it starts spitting off hydrogen. Warm it to 100 degrees, it bubbles off hydrogen quite fast. And we've got all the little glass apparatus and vacuum lines that won't bore you with to analyze the gases that come off. But that's not important. We published this stuff a number of years ago. Chuck Rice, a graduate student at that time. But we noticed also that I told you those bonds are destabilized. You put two electrons in anthracene, you can't get two in ethylene, but or benzene, but you can anthracene. You put two, it'll explode. It blows up, and it's not minor. It's shocking, you know, ear swelling, shocking. You feel it in your chest if you have a lot of it. We avoided injury, but we take very small amounts and put it in a big glass evacuated bowl. Shake the bowl, and you can see a spark. And hear a little tink, and then you can analyze the gases. Got a little local publicity from that. That's way back in 96. But the point is now, if I take the gravis lattice for palladium-deuteron, if one takes it, I shouldn't say I, we're passing electrons through, that the bonds to the deuterium are going to be broken preferentially to those to protons. You got both of them present. So the other thing is that these bonds are going to become very, very labile. There's a quote there by Roel Hoffman to show you that really electrons in the gravis lattice of a solid is quite analogous to that electrons in a molecule. The other thing is that I would bet if you had a thumb-sized piece of palladium and you had it loaded with deuterium or protons and you started putting electrons through it, you're very liable to get a major explosion, even without an LENR event. If one took place in there, that would come apart, just like the carbon systems that are quite analogous would come apart. And as I mentioned to you, when John and I started this project, we're very naive. We did not know of this conference. We knew that their papers weren't being published. We didn't know where they were being published. We were unaware of the kind of off-mainstream in journals. So I kind of will stick to mostly classical standard model. I shouldn't know it from what we just heard. But again, a series of papers there by important medal winners, people that we admire, Storms, Fleischmann, and they're accused of making mistakes in measuring tritium. Does that make any sense? I mean, there's a minor concentration variance, but you already figured that out many years ago, and these people are way beyond that. So looking at that system, we know we're seeing the H4 helium, or tritium, helium and tritium. And we're trying to figure out a mechanism for this, and it clearly, I think, we're making protons into neutrons. We're making neutrons. There's got to be neutrons coming from someplace. And of course, just standard Feynman diagram, we can't add an electron to a proton at low energies. The proton is the lightest baryon. I talked a minute ago about the weak charge, but I think that might be discounted now. But that was just published in Nature just a few weeks ago. I should mention also maybe the half-life of a neutron has been revised a few weeks ago in Science. But we have to overcome this hill of 780 keV if we're going to add an electron to a proton. Can I go to? Wittemann Larsen, I'm going to stick to things that are published in mainstream journals. I know I maybe shouldn't, but that's all I had access to at the time. I wanted to have access to, I should say. Wittemann Larsen found a way around this. And really all he's saying, and he's done it mathematically, it looks good. He's just saying that, you know, if you have an electron crossing this lattice, it has degrees of freedom other than just the x degree of translational freedom. It can go up and down due to the little monopoles in the lattice. And you add all those up, and the electron becomes relativistic, like we were hearing about just a little while ago. And it could possibly tunnel into the proton. Now, would get past the Bohr radius, which is A naught there, 137 times H bar over CME. But that ME becomes heavy, and that electron can be captured. The thing I want to mention that, you know, the gyromagnetic ratio of an electron is large compared to a proton, almost two orders of magnitude. So that's going to flip the proton, or at least scramble the spin. That's a single proton. Now, if we did that with a deuterium, the electron's going to come into a deuteron. It'll again change an up quark to a down quark, change the proton neutron into a dineutron. Get people frowning. But the dineutron is indeed intact. They're connected. If I were to take two neutrons and bring them together in space, they're never going to come together because isospin is going to keep them apart. But now what we've done is we have the proton and neutron together. The proton in the deuteron, they're connected. They're an isospin triple, a singlet, and a spin triplet. The electron that comes in flips the proton. The proton is now a neutron grabbed onto the electron, and we have an isospin triplet, but a spin singlet, and consequently, it's attached. They're connected. It's a trick, sort of, because it's done inside. They're already together. As a proton and neutron, the electron comes in, it flips over. So you're not bringing it together. And Werner Haber, who's really well-known, published in a very well-known journal, and he estimates that the binding energy is about 20 MeV. But you know what that means? That means that the deuteron can now accept an electron much easier than can a proton, because it's going downhill due to the fact that it forms a dineutron. It's concerted. So we have a downhill system. I guess I should mention I did go through the little Pauli matrices and the isospin matrices. You can look at that. And it just shows that your eigenvalues change, so you don't have a degeneracy. You have a system that will obey Fermi-Dirac statistics. Now, we drew out the Bradus lattice there, and I mentioned before we do some molecular modeling. If you model this thing, you don't have space. I said we're going to break bonds and release deuterium. There's really not enough space. I was watching one of the videos, and I think it's called Cofusion 101. Professor Engelstein was talking, and he mentioned there had to be an absent metal ion or protons or something to give space, and that works out well. I thank you for that video. That was very nice, very interesting. So what we're saying here is that the electrons come through, the electrons weaken the palladium-deuteron bond. The deuterium drops out. It drops into that cavity. If, by chance, and there's another deuterium nearby, now it becomes happenstance. You know, how the spaces are, what the morphology of this lattice is. But if by happenstance another deuterium falls, they can join, as shown at the bottom there, and it forms a D2 molecule. Now there's a plethora of electrons flowing through this system. The D2 molecule can now capture an electron in a concerted manner with the formation of the dineutron. And if it does that, we'll have a dineutron in intimate relationship with another deuteron. Again, with the continuous flow of electrons. Now, if we have, let's suppose we have some protic impurity. If we have a protic impurity, the same thing's going to happen. It's easier to break the deuterium palladium bond than it is the proton palladium bond. So preferentially, we're going to have deuteriums. But if there are enough hydrogens there, once in a while, one of those will drop down. And again, we have the same thing. So we capture the electron, and it captures exothermically, so we don't have a problem with that. And we have a dineutron intimate relationship with the proton. I try to draw out what happens. And it drops down into that little cell. Yesterday we saw some really interesting molecular modeling. I'm kind of embarrassed now. That's my art index. It's very poor. But I'm trying to show the dineutron and proton inside of there, maybe across the diagonal. And it's got phononic pressure. Got electrons go through. Phonons and electrons are everything. You know, our students can derive the Einstein crystal through phonons. So they're super important. It's obviously there. It's going to push those two together. And we're actually inside of one of those. Like, that's, again, very poor. I'm doing molecular modeling, trying to get my computer to finish a quantum mechanical calculation, and I had to load it before it finished. That's why it got kind of blurry. But if you look inside there, you can see that's the little cell that it's in. But that's space filling. That's a space filling diagram. So it shows how little space there is and why we need that empty space. That's what Engelstein said we need. I put three of them together there. But it's a nuclear active environment. I'm just going to draw it as a blob from now on, because my skills with art are poor. But the point is now, we have no Coulombic repulsion to overcome. We have a proton and a dineutron coming together, phononic pressure. they get close enough, they can undergo tunneling and join. I'm not even sure what the pressure is going to be preventing them from coming together, but Schreiner's pointed out just months ago, you know, that almost always you should consider tunneling. It's the next paradigm of reactions. So I want it in there. John and I have a little bit of experience with tunneling. We published something back in 2002 in JAX involving atoms moving back and forth and then tug conformation. It's not totally relevant, but just to show you we have a little bit of idea what we're doing. So what we have there now is that proton comes into the dineutron, very little resistance. There we go, helium, or tritium, and it's an electron-catalyzed formation of tritium. Now go back to the same thing we were talking about with the deuterium. Suppose that it's not a proton that drops down, but two deuteriums. Then something analogous happens. Only now we got the dineutron phononically compressed into a deuteron. What's going to happen? It has to be hydrogen 4. Hydrogen 4 is well known. It's got a lifetime of 136 yoctoseconds. Not very long. It's obviously we're not doing that. But, you know, they form hydrogen 4 by shooting neutrons into tritium. And all it does is spit the neutron back out. And it's in a high spin state because the neutron comes in again in the 100-volt type thing. You know. So the proton and the tritium's up, and that new neutron's up, and they're spin forbidden to come back together. But what we're maintaining is we're producing hydrogen 4m. And that would be true because the neutron, as I mentioned before, is a spin singlet, isospin singlet, and a spin, or a spin singlet, isospin triplet. Said it wrong again. Spins are both together, isospins. Axial spins are together, spins are opposite. Okay, so we're forming this hydrogen 4m, and I think it's really just a spin isomer of hydrogen 4. A hydrogen 4m undergoes an internal conversion and goes to helium 4. And that's the second one down there, but I put those other reactions just to show you that the internal conversion is well known. It's a real common thing, so there's nothing special about that. This can happen because the mass of the hydrogen 4m, metastable hydrogen 4, is less than that of a tritium and a neutron. It's greater than that of a helium and an alpha particle and electron, or a helium. So the internal conversion allows us to go directly then to hydrogen or to helium 4. Again, another coming to gravity. Okay. I just wanted to show you the spin interactions here about this metastable hydrogen. As I mentioned before, Hunsrohr, we've got the two nuclei in a place where they can't relax together because it's spin forbidden in hydrogen 4. It just spits that neutron back out, as we mentioned before, and it does it very, very, very fast. And the way the spins are arranged in our now proposed 4m hydrogen, that the new neutron and the proton are spin aligned, low energy state, it can easily fall back down, form the helium 4. So that diagram shows the energy levels and what is going on in forming the helium 4, hydrogen 4. So what we're saying is that we really just have a palladium deuteride, add an electron, we get a tremendous amount of heat, We're going through hydrogen 4m. It's really the dineutron, which is stable and connected, that's interacting with our, that timer is making me nervous, with our deuteron, and we get all of these effects. And you notice we got some alpha particles, we got some neutrons, and as I mentioned before, these things, you just got to wait for the things to drop together, the deuterium, and come together and form our reaction. This is taken directly from a paper by Fleischmann. I just lifted it off. And this thing goes for like 3 months. Nothing happens. You got to wait for the deuterium to come down, another one to come down together, and we have extreme dependence on initial conditions, scientific chaos. The reaction starts months later. It goes up and down and up and down from 32 to 60 degrees, back down to 30, back and forth. That just looks like scientific chaos. I think that we're all looking at scientific chaos to some degree. You can look at a lot of papers and you'll see that. That heat effect is corresponds with the helium 4 ash and Melvin Miles has proven that, I think, beyond any doubt in 1993, as I mentioned before at this conference. So that I noticed just also months ago, the Mosher Boss and the Kubray group have seen both the flux, feeble flux of alpha particles and neutrons. And this little paradigm that I'm trying to outline explains the evolution of hydrogen 4, evolution of hydrogen 4. The ostensible extra thermodynamic heat, it's not really extra thermodynamic, it's nuclear. It explains the evolution of tritium and why helium 4 is much more intense than tritium. And we talked about the alpha flux of chaotic sustainability. It's scientific chaos. It's hard to reproduce. Even if everything's right, it's probably hard to reproduce just because there's happenstance and you have four nonlinear equations producing the effect. The other thing, I just want to mention one last thing, the stoichiometric difference between, okay. 2 minutes? Can I have 30 seconds? The stoichiometric difference between Le and R fusion, muon fusion, is confirmed. And that, you know, Melvin Miles suffered a horrific attack from Hansen and Jones way back. And one of the attack reasons is, hey, we did muon fusion, you don't get the same result we got. No. That was in Journal of Physical Chemistry. Just one other thing, this was done, of course, before I witnessed a lot of what's going on here, but storms also showed, I think a few years ago at one of these meetings, that the 108 palladium crosses 106 during an LER experiment. That's the addition of two neutrons. So it's a dineutron. Anyway, I thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I have a short question.
Okay.
I have seen your scheme with the internal conversion decay.
Yes.
So internal conversion has good probability to occur when the energy jump is low. In the case of helium-4 in the excited states, we have 24 MeV to be released. So it should be with a low probability to occur.
Exactly. The energy is very low, is so that you can capture that electron. It's analogous to that lead system, which I showed. John actually was consulting with one of the large refineries, and they have a lead 106 problem. But the electron gets out, the beta particle gets out occasionally with that system. But we're arguing it does not with H4M.
I'm saying that that neutron is bound.
I'm saying a dying neutron is bound. It's bound.
You know the both the end, you know the scattering length of the NN, scattering length of A NN.
Yes, but
it shows never bound.
True.
Yeah.
But the trick is they never come together in the first place. If you have, they're already together, and they're spin.
You said that t equals 1, I equals 0 state is bound. You are saying that. But if so,
I
why?
Spin. It's a spin.
Spin 0, spin singlet, isospin triplet, isospin triplet is also in a deuterium state. You know that?
No, deuterium is an isospin,
but
singlet, yes.
In the deuterium, we also have isospin triplet.
Okay.
That's unbound.
Okay.
And also, they're the same group as a dineutron. Dineutron and isospin 1, spin 0, and diproton. These are the same group, and they're bound.
Okay, but calculations show it's a pi. They're not bound. That's why I put that up. They come together, exchange pi zero pi, and they're not bound. Hammer, I'm using reference now. Hammer shows that they are bound. The beryllium.
Because so far,
other experiments, they shoot.
So for many people,
as dineutron out, they come together, they go across the lab, and they're still bound. Otherwise, they go apart.
Yeah,
that's reference. It's one of the references on it. Well, I get that. But I'm aware for the calculations, Japanese calculations, way back then, it's not bound. But apparently, that's not the case anymore. And you could argue with Hammer about that. There's a lot more about it, I think, but anyway, it has to be the dineutron, otherwise you wouldn't have helium 4.
Thank you very much.